Top stories. Russia's chief negotiator in talks with Ukraine says discussions on a deal on the neutrality and non-nuclear status of Kyiv are now at a practical stage. Palestinian resistance groups hail the latest anti-Israeli operation in a suburb of Tel Aviv, calling it a legitimate response to Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. And Iran says the inhumane unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies continue to pose a serious threat to the Iranian people's right to health. Welcome to the program. The latest round of negotiations between Russia and Ukraine in Istanbul shows signs of progress. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the signals coming from the talks could be positive, but Zelensky still sees no reason to believe comments made by certain Russian representatives. He says Ukraine can only rely on a concrete outcome of the talks. This after Russia's chief negotiator said discussions on preparing a deal on the neutrality and non-nuclear status of Ukraine are now at a practical stage. Alexander Fomin said Russia would now radically ramp down military activities near Kyiv and the northern city of Chernihiv. Elsewhere, Turkey's foreign minister says his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts are now expected to meet after the two sides reached a common understanding in the Tuesday talks. Meanwhile, Washington says the West would like to see if Russia will de-escalate the operation.
Peace will have no losers, and a prolonged conflict is not in anyone's interest. This is how Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan opened the face-to-face Russian-Ukrainian negotiations in Istanbul on Tuesday. Erdogan sounded optimistic as he assured Turkey's readiness to host a meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian presidents, whom both he referred to as valuable friends. A Ukrainian negotiator told reporters that they made a series of proposals during the talks to the Russian delegation, which included a demand from Ukraine to have 8 countries as guarantors, including Turkey. While Ukraine can guarantee not having foreign military bases, meaning it would not join military alliances. Ukraine's proposal also includes a 15-year consultation period on the status of annexed Crimea. However, it could only come into force in case of a complete ceasefire.
Ukraine wants to see 8 countries, including Turkey, the US, the UK, France and Germany, as guarantor states to legally actively protect Ukraine from any aggression.
Meanwhile, the Russian negotiator said they will convey Ukraine's suggestions to the Russian president, while describing the talks as constructive. Medinsky later said during the talks with the Ukrainian delegation that Russia is not against Ukraine joining the EU. The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by foreign ministers of the two countries.
Expect a ceasefire upon these meetings, negotiations, within days, maybe through this week, through the end of this week. But this might be a limited ceasefire. I mean, the Donbas region may be out of ceasefire, but at least there will be a positive step through ceasefire. The peace agreement will take some time. The problems are very big. Donbas and Crimea are something the leaders needed to discuss and agree.
The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by the foreign ministers of the two countries. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry announced a suspension of all operations around Kyiv and Chernihiv after the meeting. Today's meeting was considered constructive, as it will pave the way for deeper negotiations between the foreign ministers of Ukraine and Russia, and hopefully reaching an agreement on a complete ceasefire. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Russia's defense minister says Moscow is now focusing on the liberation of Ukraine's Donbas region, as Ukraine's military capacity has been seriously degraded.
The main objectives of the first phase of the operation have largely been achieved. Combat potential of the Ukrainian armed forces has been substantially degraded, thus allowing us to focus our main attention and main efforts on achieving the primary goal of liberating Donbas.
Speaking to officials in a televised meeting, Sergei Shoigu said Russia is monitoring statements by the NATO countries that are after supplying aircraft and air defense systems to Ukraine. He warned that Moscow would respond appropriately if NATO goes ahead with its decision to give more backing to Kyiv. Shoigu also cautioned that the Western supply of lethal weapons to Ukraine may backfire on the Europeans themselves.
We consider the position of the West, which supplies lethal weapons to Ukraine, to be irresponsible. Its uncontrolled distribution to the population and mercenaries only exacerbates may create a threat to the Europeans themselves.
Russia says its cruise missiles destroyed a fuel depot in western Ukraine. According to Ukrainian sources, a Russian rocket hit an administration building in the south, killing 12 people. Meanwhile, Russian media say a military camp of the Russian forces near Ukraine's border has been shelled. Elsewhere, France says, given the circumstances, a humanitarian operation in Ukraine's besieged city of Mariupol remains unlikely. This after a phone conversation between President Emmanuel Macron and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, where the Russian leader said the Ukrainian nationalists in the city must first lay down arms to resolve the difficult humanitarian situation. And now, a little more than a month has passed since the beginning of the Russian offensive against Ukraine. According to the Russian leadership, the main goal at the initial stage is almost fulfilled. Our correspondent, Marina Kurtunova, has visited the frontline territory and filed this report.
For 8 years, Donbas, a region of eastern Ukraine that did not accept the results of the Kyiv coup in 2014, has been under frequent shelling from national battalions and the armed forces of Ukraine. Residents of Donbas called it a war crime against the people, and from that moment Ukraine ceased to be a state in their eyes. According to Russian investigators, the actions of the Ukrainian military led to the deaths of more than 2,600 civilians, while more than 5,500 people were injured. 2,200 civilian infrastructure facilities were destroyed.
This is a town, a school, number 50 of the sadly known town of Gorlovka in the Donbas region, which is being shelled regularly.
The last time it was shelled by Ukrainian artillery on 24th of February, the teachers died on the spot. But one of the heaviest recent shellings, hushed up by the Western media, happened on March 14 in Donetsk. The Ukrainian military hit the center of the city with a Tochka-U tactical missile equipped with a cluster warhead. The rocket was shot down, but due to the fall of debris, 23 people died and 18 were injured.
The special operation of Russia is our opportunity to defend ourselves, the possibility that the Donbas will not be destroyed and hundreds of thousands of civilians will not be lost due to the Ukrainian aggression. We will be able to remain ourselves. We will be able to speak Russian, our native language with which we were born and studied. We will have the right to relate to the history and results of the great patriotic war without manipulation. Our grandfathers and great-grandfathers can be considered the winners against fascism and in no other way. Thanks to Russia's special operation, joy and hope for a just future appeared in the Donbas.
The ultimate goal of our republic is to hold a referendum in which the people exercise their constitutional right and express their opinion on joining the Russian Federation. I'm sure that's exactly what will happen. The vast majority of the inhabitants of the Luhansk Republic have been living for 8 years under constant shelling and being in an economic and political blockade, experiencing the mockery and horrors of the Nazi battalions of Ukraine. They felt support only from the Russian Federation. With hope and a dream in our hearts, we are waiting for the opportunity to become part of the Russian Federation, to return, as they said in the Crimea, to our native harbour and start working on a great future.
The emotional answer of the head of the LPR to about holding a referendum on joining Russia caused a wide response. Later, he explained that the main task facing the leadership of the LPR now is the completion of hostilities. According to him, the battalions of Ukrainian nationalists are responsible for the murder, torture, robbery, and rape of civilians in Donbas. Most of them are relied on the experience of the commanders of the SS division during the World War II, and here in the settlement of Trehizbionka, still terrified, people did not believe in liberation and whispered about how they were bullied and subjected to violence. Here, the LPR servicemen found torture chambers with Nazi symbols hung up and the remains of those who simply disappeared from the village one day without a trace. The documents and an armaments depot were left by terrorist organization Right Sector. The LDPR military and people's militia say they collected documents about cases of cruelty against the population of Donbas and people from other regions of Ukraine. The documents include photos of people killed by bombing, runic symbols and signs of national battalions, facts of war crimes against humanity, and the positions of battalions in settlements with caches of weapons of mass destruction. When the Russian forces entered their town, Ukrainian battalions left all the civilian property destroyed. Residents of the city were forbidden to evacuate, and looting had begun. In Lugansk, servicemen showed tanks and heavy weapons left by Ukrainian militants in the liberated cities and towns. All captured grenade launchers and ammunition, armored personnel carriers, tanks and grenade launchers are productions of the UK, US, Turkey and NATO countries. Donbas leaders and citizens emphasize that the ongoing military operation of Russia was only a response to the criminal acts of Kyiv against Donbas as a timely and preemptive measure. Today, Moscow says it has documents with proof that Kyiv was preparing a large-scale attack and intended to destroy the DNR and LNR.
Russia says its aim over the past months has been to target Ukrainian military infrastructure to prevent the enemy from regrouping and reinforcing its presence in the Donbas. It says it will press ahead with a strategy until the whole region is liberated. Marina Kartunova, Lugansk region.
The self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic in eastern Ukraine says it might consider joining Russia once it controls the entire region of Donetsk. That's according to the Republic's leader, Denis Pushilin. 2 days earlier, the leader of the Luhansk People's Republic, another self-proclaimed state in eastern Ukraine, made a similar statement on the issue of a referendum to join Russia. Meanwhile, Ukraine's government has said any such vote would have no legal basis and draw a stronger international response. Russia recognized the breakaway regions in Donetsk and Luhansk as independent states ahead of its military operation in Ukraine. Kyiv says it will never agree to Russia's annexation of its territory. To other news now, there's been another shooting incident in Israel. Medics say at least five Israelis, including an officer, are killed in a gun attack in the suburb of the capital, Tel Aviv. Israeli media say officials suspect the assailant was a Palestinian from the occupied West Bank. The attacker was reportedly fatally shot. This is the third such attack in Israel within days. On Sunday, two Israeli soldiers were killed and three more injured after two Palestinians opened fire in the city of Hodeida before being gunned down. Palestinian resistance movements hailed Sunday's attack as a natural and legitimate response to Israel's occupation and crimes. The attack happened as Israel was hosting foreign ministers from the UAE, Morocco, and Bahrain, the three Arab countries that normalized ties with the regime in 2020. Last week, a Palestinian killed four Israelis in a stabbing and car ramming attack before he was shot dead by a passerby. Earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Timona Kandil, who gave us the latest reactions and details regarding the shooting attack near Tel Aviv.
Well, the Israeli military confirmed that the Palestinian man who carried out this operation that led to the killing of five Israelis and six others were wounded is from the town of Ya'bad in Jenin, Nord in the occupied West Bank. Duya Hamarshi, 27 years old. He was a Palestinian prisoner who spent years in Israeli jails and was released several years ago. Israeli forces were sent to Ya'bat village, Ya'bat town in Jenin, and more Israeli battalions were sent to the borders between the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip, as well as more battalions were sent to the borders in addition to more soldiers had been deployed at the checkpoints between the Palestinian cities and villages. Israeli officials have condemned this operation and had threatened that the response would be very painful, especially that the attacker, according to them, this time is a Palestinian from the occupied West Bank who succeeded to infiltrate into the lands that were occupied in 1948. The Palestinian resistance groups praised this operation, with Hamas movement saying that the operation is a natural and legitimate response to Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. Also, the Jihad movement has praised this operation, saying that it's a normal response and it's an operation to respond to the illegal practices, the crimes, and the acts that continue to be taken by the Israeli regime and the Israeli forces.
To Yemen now, where the Saudi-led coalition says it will halt military activities against the impoverished country from Wednesday. The coalition will conduct no operations during the holy month of Ramadan to help negotiations between Yemeni parties succeed. The announcement comes amid UN efforts to secure a truce aimed at allowing fuel ships and some flights into Yemen during Ramadan. This after Sana'a declared a unilateral ceasefire, saying it's ready for a permanent truce if Riyadh withdraws its forces and ends its siege. Now, a senior Ansarullah official says Saudi Arabia must also lift its long-running siege of Yemen. Mohammed al-Bukhaiti says otherwise Yemen's armed forces will continue military operations to break the siege. Iran's deputy UN ambassador says Washington's inhumane unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic keep seriously threatening the Iranian people's health. In an address to the UN General Assembly, Zahra Ershadi said the coercive measures by the U.S. and its allies make it harder for coronavirus-stricken nation to battle the pandemic. She said the White House claims the sanctions do not hamper Iranian imports of foodstuff and medicine, but banking restrictions make Iran's purchaser status impossible. Ershadi also said despite the sanctions, Iran has made great progress in the medical field and is now one of the few countries producing the COVID-19 vaccine.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The answer is simple. The U.S. military establishment does not care. The Pentagon and its higher ups have continuously failed to prioritize the health and safety of military members and their families, says Liz Walters Ryder in an article published under the heading $770 billion for the U.S. military, poisoned water for military families. Stay tuned for more. Concerns from hundreds of military families living on the joint naval base Pearl Harbor Hickam in Hawaii about foul-smelling drinking water were dismissed on November 29, 2021 by Naval Commander Captain Eric Spitzer, who assured residents the water was safe to drink. Spitzer declared that he and his staff were drinking the water, so surely reports of a gasoline-like odor, cramps, and vomiting were nothing to worry about. Then, less than a week later, on December 5th, Spitzer took to Facebook to issue an apology. What had happened in the days between initial denials of water contamination and the issuing of the apology? As it turns out, the companies of nearly 1,000 military and civilian households weren't unfounded. Rather, a November 20th jet fuel spill at a fuel storage facility near the base had leaked into the water supply, rendering the tap water of 93,000 residents, both military families and civilians, hazardous to drink. Tested samples from the Red Hill water shaft, one of the three sources of water for the base, contained total petroleum hydrocarbons diesel range organic, 350 times the levels considered safe for drinking water. Tests also showed gasoline range organics at more than 66 times the safe level. In short, despite the base commander's assurance on November 28 that the water on the base was totally safe to drink, it was indeed contaminated with petroleum and jet fuel. Just 2 days later, on November 30, the state health department urged families to avoid using tap water for drinking, cooking, or oral hygiene. While Hawaii Department of Health warned residents on the base against using the water, the Navy continued to deny any danger. Behind the scenes, however, the Navy had halted the use of Red Hill Fuel Storage Facility and took its Red Hill water well offline on November 27th and 28th without disclosing either decision to residents. In a December 2nd press release, the Navy admitted the Red Hill well had tested positive for petroleum but insisted the levels were too low to be deemed dangerous. On December 5th, the day Spitzer took to Facebook to apologize for encouraging families to drink the tainted water, a town hall was held on the base where concerned parents, pregnant women, and nursing mothers spoke from their hearts to Secretary of the Navy Carlos Del Toro. After apologizing for the anxiety caused by the leak, Del Toro stated, "My promise to you is we don't just leave here and forget about you." A day later, Governor David Icke and the Department of Health issued an emergency order directing the Navy to further suspend operations of the Red Hill storage tank facility until independent evaluators could prove that appropriate actions were being taken to protect drinking water. They also ordered the Navy to treat toxic drinking water and plan to remove the fuel. The Navy, however, despite Del Toro's apology and promise to take care of the military families and civilians affected, contested this order arguing that the suspension of the Red Hill fuel facility would negatively impact naval operations. Since then, the Hawaiian government and Department of Health have been pleading with the Department of Defense to drain the tanks before another disaster affects the people of Hawaii. The Navy has still not budged, despite orders from Hawaii Congressional Delegation, the Honolulu City Council, and a 13-hour Health Department hearing, after which a state hearing officer called the Red Hill facility a metaphorical ticking time bomb. This effort to protect the people of Hawaii from their military occupiers is not new. Hawaii Sierra Club and other local environmental organizations have been protesting the use of the Red Hill facility for years. Concerns that another leak was inevitable are not unfounded. The facility experienced leaks in January 2014, March 2020, and May 2021, and these are just the leaks the Navy has acknowledged. In the time since the 2014 incidents, the Navy has done little with its increasingly bloated budget to address the clear problems at the fuel facility instead of considering, for example, the gradual moving of fuel to another location not directly above Oahu's water supply. The Navy has used its power to keep its precious fuel where it is, despite the threat posed to its own members, their families, and the citizens of Hawaii. The catastrophic history of Red Hill and the Navy's stubborn resistance to pleas for greater protection of residents of the area raise questions about the role of the military in the lives of ordinary citizens in the land in which military units have inserted themselves. How can the military possess such exorbitant wealth and power yet not respect and protect the most basic human rights, safe drinking water, for the very people responsible for their functioning? How could the Navy allow its own service people, their families, and civilians on the base to consume poison for days, knowing full well that a jet fuel leak had taken place above the water supply on November 20th? Why is the U.S. Department of Defense fighting tooth and nail to guard its fuel instead of prioritizing the health of its service members, their families, and the people of Hawaii? The answer is simple. The military establishment does not care. The Pentagon and its higher ups have continuously failed to prioritize the health and safety of military members and their families. The Red Hill disaster is just one more example of the U.S. Department of Defense disregard for human lives when those lives get in the way of their expensive, deadly operations. Does this disregard make you as angry as it should?
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us contemplate upon what the Holy Prophet's 11th infallible successor, Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him, said when asked about the promised Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. He will be my son, the namesake of the Prophet. Whoever dies without knowing him will die the death of ignorance. His absence will be so lengthy that the ignorant will wander puzzled and would surely stray from the right path. But the righteous shall remain steadfast and pray for their Imam to appear within their lifetime. congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature. Happy Iranian New Year!
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajahum. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human justice, and we are looking at human justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam. We were looking at a letter written by the commander of the faithful himself, given to one of his disciples, one of his commanders, Malik al-Ashtar, where if we examine that letter itself, we get to see that the true essence of justice, the true essence of human rights, are included in this letter. Now, we don't have time to examine the entire letter, rather, we will take some parts of it and we can see how we can apply it to our modern day and how justice was applied in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen compared to the countries and the systems that we live under today. One of the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen mentions in this letter is the collection of revenue. Now, obviously, any country will not exist from the economy aspect unless it has sources of revenue, whether it is agriculture or oil or gold or coal or gas. They must have a source where they have to cultivate and generate a source of income. Now, that is important that a country should use the resources and find means to create revenue, because obviously there are people, the rights of other people depends on it. So for example, we see Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he talks to Malik al-Ashtar, he says to him, you have to ensure the prosperity of those who pay the revenue to the state. And that's extremely important. Why? Because the farmers, for example, or businessmen, or those who are traders. Now, those are the ones that create revenue for the country. It's the job of the government, the job of the system, to take care of those people. As long as those businessmen, those farmers, those tradesmen are actively working, then they will give back in taxes, or in khums, or sadaqah, or charity, or zakah. At the end of the day, they will give back revenue to the government, which in return, the government gives to the poor people. If those people, the tradesmen and the farmers and what have you, if they are themselves deprived, then what happens is, the people and the masses will be deprived. So Amir al-Mu'mineen is saying to him, take care of those people. Make sure they are prosperous. Make sure they're happy. Make sure that their needs is set. Why? Because on their prosperity depends the prosperity of others, and particularly the masses themselves. Indeed, in the state exists on its revenue. the state itself, it's only existing because of the revenue that it makes. Now, we will continue this, but first, let us take a short break.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying that revenue is extremely important for the government and for the state. And this revenue, there are those who generate it. And those who generate those revenues or those revenues, they need to be taken care of because on them, many people are depending. So this was the advice of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam to Malik al-Ashtar. And then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi highlights an important factor. He says you should regard the proper upkeep of the land and cultivation as of a greater importance than the collection of revenue. Now, this is obviously Amir al-Mu'mineen. He's taking one dimension of revenue because obviously back in the day, the main revenue was from cultivating the lands and farms. Now we have oils and gas and minerals and mines and what have you. So when you look at farming, for example, and obviously the life of people depends on farming because we need the wheat and flour, we need the fruits and vegetables and what have you. This is what we live on. We don't live on biscuits and sweets, do we? So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, what's more important than collecting the revenue is that you have to make sure that the land is, people can cultivate the land and they have the means to cultivate it. Because if the land itself is not cultivated, then there will be nothing grown, no crops will grow. If no crops will grow, there will be no revenue to make. The land will not produce anything. For revenue, he says, cannot be derived except by making the land productive. If the land itself is not productive, then it's not going to give you anything. And this is something that we see in a lot of countries that they don't pay attention to. When other countries, for example, want to export their own products to another country, if they have an influence on that country, they make sure that the lands are not cultivated. They make sure that the lands do not get the right means. For example, if we look at Africa, America and the West want to sell their products, whether it's wheat, flour, or rice, to those countries. In order for them to sell their products, they have to make sure that their lands don't get cultivated. There is no revenue in the land itself. Otherwise, there will be no need for them. So you can see that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi is saying that should not happen. In your own state, the main focus should be on revenue that you make yourself, that you need to go back to your land and cultivate the land. Now, you can cultivate the land by either growing on it, by digging mines and getting gold and silver and iron and whatever minerals are required, or you can even cultivate it when it comes to oil. Do your own work. Through this kind of method of cultivating one's land, then I could ensure the prosperity and the happiness of my people and the happiness of the masses. Otherwise, we're going to have a lot of poverty, we're going to have a lot of ignorance, and everything will fall apart. So from here, he's saying to Malik, make sure that your land is cultivated. Those who cultivate the land are being taken care of. And also that you need to create revenue in order for you to help and support the masses. We'll leave it up to here, and inshallah we will continue in the episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abach Archaeological Park was occupied for 1700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Takalik Abach is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even Mayan spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination, is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, is celebrated worldwide by millions of people, including the people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The region, known for its natural beauty worldwide, turns magical each year during its spring season. To mark nature's revival, the people of Kashmir have dedicated a day to thank the mesmerizing beauty of spring. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colorful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glassy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year, we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth, and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of 2.5 billion euros. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around 14 US dollars to use the bridge. In Peru, paleontologists have unearthed the skull of a ferocious marine predator that is an ancestor of the modern-day whale. The 36-million-year-old skull was dug up intact after it was discovered in Peru's southern desert. The fossil belongs to an ancient mammal whose contemporary descendants include dolphins. Recreations of how the animal looked like show it mostly resembles a giant lizard that moved like a snake. Paleontologists say it was a top predator measuring some 12 meters long.
The discovery is very important because the skull is in a perfect state of preservation. The skull and the jaw are in the right anatomical position. The teeth are complete. It's very possible this might be a new Basilosaurus species. If this is so, there is no other fossil like this one anywhere else in the world.
Salas further explained when the ancient animal died, its skull might have sunk to the bottom of the seafloor, where it was quickly preserved. The skull, measuring 1.3 meters long, was unveiled at Lima's Museum of Natural History. The Peruvian desert is rich in fossils and offers scientists 42 million years' worth of evolutionary evidence. Other fossils found there include the four-legged dwarf whale and sharks, among others.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A painter in Pakistan shifts from trucks to trainers to uncover a hip new canvas for his famous truck art. Haydar Ali says he works on each pair of shoes for up to 4 days, and his paint of choice is mainly acrylic. He also uses other forms of durable material, such as oil paints, to get the job done. The seasoned artist charges select clients $400 for each set. His designs feature intricate bespoke patterns, including flowers, peacocks, and wildly colorful motifs. He says new requests typically arrive every 4 days. Orders for painted trainers started pouring in for the truck artist after a surge of social media interest.
Ideas keep popping up for me, and sometimes clients have ideas. A client came to me from the US asking for a painting on some shoes. I told him an exorbitant fee to discourage him, but he agreed, so I decided, let's do it then.
He has dispatched 8 pairs to various places in Pakistan and abroad since he first started painting trainers in January. Ali comes from a family of truck artists who made a living off of painting lorries. He came to international fame when his work was exhibited at a museum in the US 2 decades ago. So far, the veteran truck artist has applied his craft to an airplane as well as a passenger car, among others. The art form is mainly seen on Pakistani trucks, and today, the trade is one of the country's most famous cultural exports.
Archaeologists have discovered a 500-year-old Aztec altar with 164 in Mexico City, Mexico's largest starfish offering discovered to date. Archaeologists believe it was built around the year 1500. Jaguar bones and other remains such as seashells were also found. Scientists believe the fossils found correspond to a species known as chocolate chip sea star or Nidorella armata.
This is really interesting because if you think about it, chocolate chip sea star looks like the skin of a jaguar. It's orange with the dark spots. Probably that is why this species was selected, but we still need to analyze all the starfish because we found 160 of them and we think they all belong to the same species. But we need to research further every one of them.
According to experts, the location of the altar within the Templo Mayor complex and the jaguar motifs suggest the offering was related to the war. Mexico is brimmed with archaeological sites of several civilizations, including Aztecs. Retired race horses could be retrained for a new role as so-called therapy horses. According to a study led by the University of Bristol, veterans and disabled children, as well as those struggling with mental health issues, can benefit from the therapy horses. The 3-year study aims to provide a global standard for the racing industry and a toolkit for retraining race horses. A racehorse's career can last anywhere between 2 and 10 years, but better could be done to make use of these beautiful creatures soon after they're retired.
So racehorses, when they finish their racing careers, and they can finish as young as sort of 3 or 4 years old, they really don't want to be just standing around in fields for the next 20, 30 years. And they're so versatile that I really believe there's a job for 99% of them. I think there's almost a sixth sense with the horse. People needing therapy, whether that's mental health or physical disabilities, there seems to be sort of something that gels between a horse and a human.
Horse trainers say with the thoroughbred's lifespan between 25 to 30 years, this study's aim is crucial for their long-term welfare. Over 7,000 racehorses end their career every year in Britain, with many going into eventing and pleasure riding. A killer whale beached on a Mexican shore has been rescued by locals and environmentalists. Volunteers with a group called Youth Allied to the Environment helped carry the orca out of the sea. The whale was loaded onto a truck and taken to a large dock for medical examination. Volunteers say locals gathered to form a human chain in an effort to quickly fill the tub with water. The orca is being treated at a marine biology department of the Yucatan Autonomous University. Veterinarians say the whale appeared to have some pulmonary problems and will be released back to the ocean after the recuperation.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Without any declared candidacy and with little spent on Republican candidates, the purpose of former US President Donald Trump's war chest remains opaque. We have prepared for you an article written by Edward Helmore. The piece is titled Questions Abound as Trump Raises and Hoards Huge Sums of 2024 Cash. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Donald Trump's ferocious money-raising machine, powered in equal measure by grassroots giving and large individual and corporate donations, has never really stopped turning, and it is currently raising huge sums of cash. As of this month, Donald Trump has $108,046,100 saved in his Save America political fund, more than the Republican and Democratic National Committees combined, and 12 times as much as the fund PAC for the Future for the Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And all of that has been raised while Trump's own ambitions remain unclear. Though his grip on the Republican Party remains tight and he has waged an endorsement war against his opponents, the big question over whether Donald Trump will run again for the White House remains unanswered. Without any declared candidacy, his war chest purpose and thus also that of its master is unclear, and deliberately so. Donald Trump cannot easily spend the money on himself should he decide to run in 2024. Save America is registered as a leadership PAC, or political action committee, not a campaign tool for himself. According to its leadership purpose of supporting Republican candidates going into this year's hotly contested midterm elections, yet Trump is not spending much. Despite Donald Trump's more than 120 Republican endorsements, and even as Democrats pour money into their effort to retain control of Congress, the massive accumulation of cash under his control raises the question, what is it for? Donald Trump has not stopped raising